From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made a couple hours ago at City Hall in Rochester, where community leaders issued a proclamation declaring today Rochester's first National Day of Racial Healing Participation. Now, as part of the initiative, Rochester participates in a multi-year project called Let's Get Real, R-E-A-L, standing for Race, Equity, and Leadership. The project includes a charter with steps for advancing racial equality through policy decisions, civic engagement, and accurate and complete portrayals of people of color in the community. It's the latest in a series of efforts to bridge racial divides in our community, where tensions have run high, especially in recent weeks. Meanwhile, the Gandhi Institute is preparing to host its own program about the diversity advantage, how society benefits when inclusion transforms into full equality. The program was organized by community members who connected with each other, at least partially through a discussion right here on this program last year. There's a lot to talk about this hour, from what full equality truly looks like to what racial healing requires. And our guests will share their perspectives. Certainly, we wanted someone from the city of Rochester to be able to join us as we talk about the National Day of Racial Healing, but the city chose not to participate as they tend to do with this program. But we do have some guests in studio to talk about the various perspectives here. Mara Ahmed is a political activist, artist and writer, and an independent filmmaker at Neelam Films. Mara, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Mary Scipione, who is a landscape architect, a writer and a critic, and owner of Pebble Stream. Mary, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And Tana Bakhmetyeva is an associate professor of gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Rochester, and associate academic director for the Susan B. Anthony Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies. Tanya, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
What happened last time you were here, Mara, that you made this? The show's called Connections, and lo and behold, you get a phone call. Tell the story. This is a wonderful story.
Yeah, so a while back when I was here talking about my third film, A Thin Wall, which is about the partition of India in 1947, I was talking about how the creation of nation states is always based on some kind of justification. And that justification is usually some kind of homogeneity. So, for example, talking about the context of the Indian subcontinent, the British, when they left in 1947, created a Hindu majority India and a Muslim majority Pakistan, with the assumption that there was some kind of religious uniformity within these two nation states. Now, my argument was that this homogeneity is, in fact, an illusion. So we obviously know that there are minorities both in India and in Pakistan. And so what the state does is, in order to create this semblance of uniformity, they try to use state violence to either assimilate that difference or to erase that difference. And so the reason that that happens and the reason that this violent project is never going to end and will never be successful is because the subscription to one kind of monolithic ethnic or religious identity is simply impossible. And what is natural is, in fact, diversity. And so I was talking about that when someone called in and she introduced herself as Mary. She said she was a landscape architect. And she said, I come at diversity from a very different perspective, from the perspective of resiliency theory and how diversity makes sense for plant environments because it makes them stronger and more resilient. Well, I was just fascinated by that because it was, you know, something that I didn't know much about. And so after the show, I Googled Mary, landscape architect, Rochester, and I actually found her, and we had lunch together, and we decided to bring this conversation into the community, and then we said, why not expand it and bring more people on board and approach diversity from different areas of specialization? So I talked to Tanya, who teaches gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Rochester. I talked to my friend Lutetia, who is a disability advocate, but also a brilliant scientist. And then Kristen Hawker, who works with diversity and inclusion and can talk about how that is put into practice in the real world. And lo and behold, we now have a community discussion that's coming up on the 26th at the Gandhi Institute at 2 o'clock. And I also want to mention our supporters and co-sponsors for this event, the History Department at the University of Rochester, Rochester Global Connections, and the Association of American University Women.
I love this. So Saturday, 2 o'clock at the Gandhi Institute, this event, From Inclusion to Equity, the Diversity Advantage, is free and open to the public. So if you're someone who has heard about the idea that, well, diversity can be an advantage, that there are studies about workplaces and studies about classrooms, But you sort of wonder about that. I think this analogy to nature is fascinating, and I can't wait to talk more about that. But your chance to learn about that in depth, Saturday, 2 o'clock, Gandhi Institute in Rochester, free. Where's the Gandhi Institute?
Oh,
that's a good question.
Fifth Avenue.
What is the address?
I'm not sure if it's 989, but it's on Plymouth Avenue, in the Plex neighborhood. Yeah.
Yeah, you can Google it.
Yes.
So Mary, when you called the program, I'm with Mara. I thought the points you were making were points that I had never heard in this sort of analogy, but they immediately made sense. And so what my mind went to at that moment was, the amount of effort it took to grow just a grass lawn, the amount of eliminating of other types of growth on a front lawn just to make it look like a monoculture is amazing. And yet in this country, if you have dandelions, your neighbors go like, well, you're going to pull those dandelions, as opposed to going, well, lots of things like to grow together. And the amount of work we have to do to eliminate those things that want to grow, that's where my mind was. Tell me about your thought on making that phone call.
Well, there are three things I can talk about, and I'll just address the first two right away. First of all, as a landscape architect, one of our parent disciplines is landscape ecology, which is a relatively new discipline. It's about 50 years old. And landscape ecology studies the relationship between the patterns in the landscape and the processes, so behavior of species, movement of species, dynamic exchange, and so on. And so the interesting thing about landscape ecology is they set it up in such a way, the theory, so that there is absolutely no distinction between the natural environment and the built environment. So you can easily move from the forest to the city and apply the same principles when you're looking to assess resiliency, for example. So landscape ecologists have studied for resiliency of forest communities, for example, and so on, and they actually pin down the five essential characteristics for a resilient system. This doesn't mean, you know, defense against attack. It means being of your nature resilient. So it's more of a bending and not breaking kind of resiliency rather than the seawall type of resiliency. So they did determine that there were five specific characteristics that could be analyzed or applied on three or different scales, and that would give you a model to build a resilient system. The first of these is diversity. And so that is kind of what made the connection between Mara's conversation and mine, because this does translate into urban communities, for example.
So when it comes to that diversity, do we too often want sort of homogeneity as opposed to appreciating and seeing the advantage of diversity in sort of in as your field sort of sees it?
Well, it's not about just letting everything grow where it wants to. It's about being intentional about creating architecture. For example, if you think about plants, their branch structures, their posture, their leaf surface areas and how they're articulated, those are all habitats. So think of them as like urban dwellings. The more different choices you have, the more different types of species will be there. And the more species there are, the more they self-regulate and are able to respond to any kind of disturbance.
So my front lawn, not the best analogy, but you know, how do you feel about that, Mary?
Well, lawns are an aberration, and it's one of the things that we can all do on our individual level to go towards a more sustainable environment. It's a monoculture, and it's what you call ecologically sterile.
Interesting.
So, not only that, it requires great inputs of energy, chemicals, all things that run off in stormwater end up in our streams and rivers, and therefore, you know, impact our freshwater systems.
All right, I feel a little bit better about the analogy now. But creating that monoculture takes so much work, so much sort of toxicity added just to keep everything else out.
Well, like it does politically as well.
Yeah.
You have to apply energy and negative elements in order to preserve this impossible to maintain homogeneity.
You have to apply violence.
Yes.
Some kind of violence, right?
That's an interesting way of looking at that. And by the way, so when you guys got together, you got together over coffee or lunch and you just started talking after that phone call that Mary made last time you were here? Yeah.
that's what happened. And then I just started looking for other people who would bring in their area of specialization, their expertise, and kind of approach diversity from a different perspective, which is what we wanted.
All right. So as a side note to listeners, if you ever have a great story like this, hey, Evan, I was listening to the program and I literally reached out to this person or to this organization, or I got together with someone, or I had lunch with someone who has an interesting point of view. I love these stories. And you can always email us, connections@wxxi.org. If you want to call the program this hour, it's 844-295-TALK, as we talk about what really full equality looks like and the diversity advantage. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me bring in Professor Bakhmetyeva. How do you view this issue?
Well, I teach at the university, so my job is to always complicate all the issues. So I'm going to complicate it a little bit, even though we talk about how much effort it requires to keep it, to keep everything clean and homogeneous. Diversity also requires an enormous effort, because if we think about diversity ecosystems being resilient and also beautiful, because there's a variety and they support each other, different species and different plants support each other, and there's kind of mutual benefits. But there's also an enormous effort that goes into maintaining and sustaining this diverse ecosystems, because every plant requires its own amount of water, its own resources. So all plants are created equal, and not all plants require the same resources. So, and this is how we get to kind of two different words, equity versus equality. And if you notice, our panel is about equity, but we seem to be using words equity and equality interchangeably. And I just want to separate them and say that equality is when everyone has equal access to the same resources. But it actually doesn't always help people in the same way. And equity is when we understand which resources each individual plant or each individual person needs, and we provide these resources. And I think that the way to achieve true diversity, and diversity for me is a concept. When we think about diversity, we have to think about people. What does diversity mean? It means not necessarily creating just resilient environments, but also empowering people and providing resources that each person needs to include them into the structures of decision-making structures of power. And to do this, we need equity, not just equality. And equity means understanding which resources each individual needs to be in the structures of power and decision making.
So, Professor, as you say, in your role of a professional complicator,
yes.
do you see conversations about equity as oversimplified at times and maybe missing some of these important complexities? Are we sort of inhibiting our progress because we oversimplify at times?
I think conversations about equality sometimes are oversimplified, because it's, again, equality stresses that, well, if we only provide the same resources, then everything will be for the same people and same access to those resources, things will be simple. But it's not as simple, because, again, if we use the analogy that Mary used, and I really like this analogy of plants and diverse ecosystems, each plant requires a different amount of water and different amount of sunlight. And we need to acknowledge it. And true gardeners, people who really cultivate diverse ecosystems, understand this need, and they will be attentive to every plant, each and every plant. So I think when we begin to shift from these conversations of equality, which I think is oversimplifying the issue, to equity, we begin to see nuances of the difficulties of building true diverse systems and difficulties of the process.
And this is where it seems that intersectionality comes into
right.
play.
Yes.
And you know, that has become not just kind of a hot or sort of a buzzword in especially in social media spheres, but also I think it's become a flashpoint for political division and mm-hmm. suspicion that for some reason I understand some of the intellectual arguments that people are making. They're concerned that intersectionality will lead to suppression of voices. I don't find a whole lot of merit to that, but I do understand the concern that it could happen. But Professor, I think intersectionality acknowledges the complexities
right.
and the
yep.
various struggles and how they can be layered upon one another, and that sort of has kind of come up in various women's marches in
right.
just around the country here. Some have been canceled due to a lack
right.
of diversity. How do you view, when you kind of see those actions, interactions, that even within the so-called women's movement or women's marches, How do you view that difficult conversation on intersectionality?
I see these difficult conversations happening in my classroom every single day because we have, I teach courses on feminism. We have, and I have students who come from very diverse, very different backgrounds where issues of intersectionality really powerfully exhibit themselves every day in these. And I remind students, and I just want to remind everyone, we're at a moment of a very important, very difficult cultural conversation where there are major cultural shifts happening in our society. And it's, I think, only natural to expect confusion, expect fear, expect resentment, expect pushback. So I think there are some unfortunate developments, but I think they're inevitable, and we're working through them. Basically, my sense is this is a natural reaction of the system that's been homogeneous for too long to attempts to make it more diverse and more complex.
And
so,
this is where, Professor, and I don't intend to overly politicize. I'm very curious to know what all of our guests think here, but when you talk about, you know, the ways that we can oversimplify to the detriment either of an issue or a movement or a cause, this is where sometimes you hear, and generally I'm talking about the political left, this debate about whether, hey, we just need to set everything aside and unify because we're not winning elections, et cetera, et cetera. We're not changing policy. We're not reaching our goals. We have to unify. We have to ignore those inner divisions, whereas others are arguing, no, this is the time to examine why there are power structures that advantage some and disadvantage others. And if not now, then when will we ever? And that doesn't have to pull us apart entirely, but it is necessary work even now. How do you view that?
In addition to being a gender studies scholar, I'm also a historian. and I can refer to several moments in history where this exactly conversation really took place. Let's forget about this for now. We will address it later. That's first wave of feminism, second wave of feminism, where major groups and large groups of people were excluded, either because of their race or because of their sexual orientation. Let's not include lesbian feminists into second wave feminism marches. Because they will make us look bad. So you alienate people, but you also don't get anywhere because essentially if you are fighting for a very small cause and you basically saying we'll address the rest of it later, you usually don't get anywhere. So historically, it failed. And we basically where we are now, it's because we continue the same, seem to be continuing the same pattern. Let's exclude these people now and we'll address their needs later.
Okay, Mara?
I just actually wanted to add what I had to say. I wanted to talk about like more theory and more philosophical concepts, because I feel like Mary and Tanya can definitely talk about diversity in a more grounded way. But I think ideas and philosophy are also important because they help us imagine a different world. So Tanya was talking about how unity or uniformity is needed in a lot of movements right now. And so I wanted to bring in the work of writer, theorist, and philosopher Edouard Glissant, who is a Martinican thinker, and he lived in Paris and Martinique most of his life. And he wrote The Poetics of Diversity, which teaches us how to live in a world of chaos. And again, going back to some of the stuff that Tanya was saying, you know, I just want to explain what he means by world of chaos. So particularly in the present, in our present world of globalization, there are a lot of different types of people with different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different languages, different cultures, different religions, and they are all coming increasingly into contact with one another. So on the one hand, you have this increased interface and this increased connectivity between people who are very different. And then on the other hand, you have these very atavistic national, ethnic, racial identities, you know, that are being codified and solidified by political rhetoric all over the world. So obviously, when you have these two things, what happens is that there's tension, there's confusion, and there's conflict. And how do we resolve that? So in the past, there was this idea of unity, which was a very European idea, the idea of European universalism, which meant that Europe was the driver of history and Europe was the end destination for the rest of the world. And so they had like this one-size-fits-all kind of template that the rest of the world had to follow. Modernity, for example, is what everyone is supposed to aspire to. Modernity as defined you know, defined in a very Eurocentric way. And that's why, you know, we have the ranking of first world countries and second world and third world. Like, what does it mean to be a third world human being? It means that we are ranking you based on where you stand on this spectrum of modernity, which is defined by the West. So Gleason talks about this kind of thinking, and he calls it continental thinking, because it's coming from mainland Europe, and it's all about self-reference and self-demarcation. And in opposition to that, he offers something completely different. He offers archipelagic thinking. And an archipelago, is, of course, a group of islands. And he's obviously talking about the Caribbean. And how that system works is quite different, because you have a lot of differences, a lot of different parts and components that exist simultaneously and are equal to one another and are characterized by exchange and constant negotiation and constant interaction. So this is what he proposes, as opposed to this very old idea of continental thinking.
Hmm. You want to add to that, Mary?
Certainly. First of all, diversity is very much in vogue in landscape design now, whereas back in the olden days, when people were living in fortified towns, there was a real need to structure plants in a very rigid way. For example, orchards were developed so that they could see if any animals, wild animals, were coming. So it was for visual control. And later on, you know, it was about understanding geometries and, you know, the whole optics revolution that happened in France in the 17th century and so on. So there was massive developments in garden design for the royalty. But today, perennial meadows are really the thing. And if you were going to design a perennial meadow, what you would do is you would take each species and lay it out in these big, long drifts, okay, as opposed to segregating them into a grid, okay? So follow me here. This drift has two purposes, at least. It has actually more than two purposes. But what it does is it exposes that species to a diversity of microclimate, a diversity of site conditions, so that there's more opportunity for that species to survive. It might not be exactly where you think it's going to be. And the other thing it does is it creates more surface area for contact with all the other species. So as the meadow grows, the plants begin to migrate, and they find their own pattern. And that's because there's a spontaneous, localized interaction, the constant negotiation. So you can see this is a similar model to what Mara was talking about. I call it the trickle-up organizational model, and which I think is much better than a trickle-down organizational model. And it's based on the concept of designing for premeditated uncertainty.
That fits in, again, fits in beautifully with Edouard Glissant, because he talks about how diversity is differences constantly encountering each other, negotiating with each other, adjusting to each other, opposing each other, agreeing with each other, and in doing so, all the time producing unpredictability. So that's also an interesting idea, is that you're always moving towards an unknowable outcome. Because if you really truly engage with diversity and allow yourself to be changed by it, then how can we know where we're going to end up?
Let me read a little feedback from a listener. Dan says, really appreciating this conversation, and has a couple of points, and I'll read them separately for our guests. He says, number one, he says, diversity makes us stronger is not necessarily true. Diversity has the potential to make us stronger, but only if we value that diversity. We have to want it, or it will only stoke pre-existing divisions and anxieties. This is why saying diversity makes us stronger is not productive. It doesn't show its work or seek to prove its assertion. So the people who believe it continue to do so, and the people who don't, don't. One has to inspire people to see the value of diversity, to give them the sight to recognize it is a positive thing. How else will anyone be convinced to change their mind? I'll start with you, Mara. What do you make of that point?
I think I agree with that, and I think that's exactly what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. We're trying to kind of debunk it and break it open and talk about it from very different perspectives.
So in some ways, the event, which is, again, on Saturday at the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester, free and open to the public, called the Diversity Advantage. It starts at 2 p.m. I suspect it's you would love to have an audience of people who don't think diversity is an advantage or is a positive. But at the same time, even if you have a lot of like-minded people, maybe you give them the tools to have these conversations instead of just sort of trying to bludgeon people with diversity is good. Don't you see diversity is good? What Dan is saying, you have to explain why. People may be open to it if you can convince them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think that diversity is just a nice thing to do. I think that it's a thing that makes sense. And there are very tangible, concrete, palpable ways in which we can prove that diversity works, like what Mary was talking about. So, and what Tanya was talking about, how in the women's movement, for example, diversity is what makes sense. And a model where there's any kind of exclusion is a model that's never going to be successful. So that's exactly what we're trying to do, I think.
Okay. Tanya, what would you say to Dan's point?
Well, I think Dan's point was also that it can be good, but to suggest just in a blank statement that diversity is always good is perhaps an overstatement, an oversimplification. But he said, it can be good if it works, because I mean it's quite simple. You have people with different ways of thinking, different ways of understanding things, and when they engage in a productive conversation, it could lead to some interesting advances of whatever setting you're working in. But as we also discussed before, your question was a look at what's happening now, all this intersectionality issues that some people are getting very concerned because they seem to be leading to lack of unity in particular movements. And I think Mara's discussion was of this idea of unity and our striving for unity as something that's kind of Eurocentric and Western-centric. I think that that's a great illustration.
Yeah.
Yes, diversity is not an easy thing. Diversity can lead to chaos, like you were saying, and unpredictability. So, and we have to embrace all of it and work through those issues to arrive at the potential. And Dan was referring to it. It has a potential, and we have to uncover this potential. And we don't know it yet, perhaps. But we also see companies, if we kind of adopt our economic model and looking at economic advantages of diversity. Companies that are more diverse, they're more creative. They have more interesting projects. They have more interesting innovations. But diversity can work in various areas of life. But it has a potential. But you know, it also has a potential to be chaotic and unpredictable. And that's also beautiful.
Okay, Mary, what would you say to Dan?
Well, I think, again, I'm going to focus on diversity of opportunity, mm-hmm. meaning the structure of the environment, but let me move it into the city. For example, in the Bay Area of California, people have to drive. People who work as firemen or teachers may have to drive to work 2.5 hours because there is no habitat for them, quote unquote, in San Francisco. Then you look at the West Village in New York back in the middle of the last century, where the neighborhoods were diverse. So there were shopkeepers and carpenters, and everyone lived in the same neighborhood, and they were able to exchange goods and services in a more enriched way. Now, I spent a lot of time in Italy, and I can tell you that because Venice had become so expensive and so precious, also because of its perishability, you can't find a plumber in Venice. I mean, it's a lagoon, but no plumber can live anywhere near Venice. That's the risk when you're not diverse. So if you go back to species and forests, when there's disturbance, like there is right now socially, social disturbance, when there is disturbance, the more diversity you have in those that are facing the disturbance, the more likely that you're going to have a possibility for partial survival and recombination in a way that rebuilds the society in a new way. So it's a recombination that happens. Resiliency isn't just about fighting things off, as I said before. It's mm-hmm. about going with the flow. Change is a designer. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind. And the other issue is, if I might, it's very hard to make people change as adults, but we need to start opening up these environments and creating these habitat drifts while people are children, because it's familiarity that is one of the biggest problems. So if children are familiar with one another and grow up side by side, then maybe it won't be such a struggle to try to discover what lies in, because children are naturally curious about things that are different. And I think that it's harder to retroactively mm-hmm. make people understand the richness that comes from diversity.
Can I just follow up on one point you're making about, say, take Venice. I think the point you're making is plumbers can't live in Venice because they can't afford it?
That's right.
Okay. And you can certainly immediately understand that's a problem.
Yes.
May take you a while to get any service. What would you do structurally? I mean, and again, I'm going to put you in charge of all of Venice right now, Mary. But but what do we do about that? If there's a lack of sort of diversity of opportunity, of income, of a chance to kind of live among one another, what do we start to do there?
Well, first of all, I think if you're talking about Venice,
yeah, sure.
The biggest opportunity for habitat you need to find is for water. So the first thing that I would want to do with Venice is create incursions into the mainland with built waterways and water retention facilities like ponds and estuarian habitats. And then from there, you can start to build up the, you have to have housing for people who need to service the community. And that is very challenging right now. There are other issues that are regulatory issues. For example, they now have these massive cruise ships coming into Venice that when they're next to the Palazzo dei Doggi, it dwarfs these beautiful palaces that were built in the 1400s and in 1500s and unloads this enormous amount of tourism. Have you been? You've been to Venice, right?
I've not.
Oh, well, I don't go in the summertime. It's lovely in the fall, late fall, when it gets foggy and misty and cold and nobody wants to visit it. And that's when you should go to Venice. But so I think it's first the environment that has to be made to survive. And then it can survive. The species can survive on top of that. And you need to create the layers.
All right. So listeners, I see the phone ringing. I've got more email to read. It's already 12:37, so we've got to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back. Much more from our guests. We'll get your feedback as we talk about the Diversity Advantage. That's an event that's coming your way on Saturday. From inclusion to equity, the Diversity Advantage. Free and open to the public at the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. The event starts at 2 o'clock on Saturday. Our guests will be there. You're hearing Mary Scipione, who is a landscape architect, writer and critic, and owner of Pebble Stream. You're hearing Professor Tanya Bakhmetyeva, who is an associate professor of gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Rochester, and associate academic director for the Susan B. Anthony Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies. And Mara Ahmed is a political activist, artist, and writer, and independent filmmaker at Neelam Films. So let's get that only break and much more of your feedback straight ahead. Coming up in our second hour, Pew Research finds that men in particular in this country don't think things have gotten easier in the workplace because of Me Too. Men tend to think that it's harder now to interact with women, that men are worried that if they say something, it'll be perceived as harassment when they're just trying to be kind. Is that really happening, though? We discuss the issue next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we get a little bit of your feedback, I know Mara wanted to add a point about Dan's email regarding diversity as sort of an inherently good thing that doesn't need to be explained versus requiring explanation.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, even the discussion about is diversity good, is diversity bad, is a bit irrelevant as far as I'm concerned, because I think diversity is just natural. Human beings are just natural. Like, you have naturally different. Like, we just have to deal with that. And I think that's why I like the work of Edouard Glissant, because he's coming from this assumption, yeah, people are different, cultures are different, religions are different. That's just a fact. So unless you use force in order to generalize, homogenize, and assimilate, which is a very violent process, unless you do that, you have no option but to live with the concept of diversity and difference.
Professor?
And I also want to add, because I find this conversation sometimes unproductive when we're talking about is diversity good or is diversity bad? Because our society is highly diverse. It's perhaps the most diverse society I can imagine. And I come from Russia, which is also pretty diverse, but I think, our diversity here in the States, it does not compare to it. So what does it mean that is diversity good or bad? We are diverse. When we talk about diversity, that basically means making sure that our social diversity is reflected in every area of our life. That means bringing people of diverse backgrounds to participate in decision-making process because they're already there. And they, we are diverse. So yes, how can we say good or bad? Is diversity good or bad? Can it be potentially complicated or not complicated? We are diverse. we just have to make it work.
Well,
basically.
We literally are in a position in this country, but also in many countries around the world with resurgent movements, and I don't mean majority or even pluralities of populations, but resurgent movements of ethno-nationalism, calls for ethno-states, or there's such fear of diversity among some quarters that this conclusion that some are drawing is that it's just too unsafe. As if we could even do it if we wanted to, as if we could create some sort of borders in which like people would be with like people. I mean, I find it so frustratingly unrealistic and absurd, but I still try to engage when it's in good faith. When the conversation is such a fear of diversity, I take Dan's point on the email and at least try to engage it in good faith, even though that horse has left the barn a long time ago. We're not dividing into like versus like. I don't even know how you do it. So anyway, I take the point, Tanya and Mara, that this is what the world we have. So like, you know, good, bad, whatever, this is the world we have.
This is the world we have. And so you can be very paranoid about it, like you said, and fear difference and fear unpredictability. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of parts of the world right now, where we're building walls and fences and separating and compartmentalizing and having Muslim bans and trying to eject and deport any difference that we see. So you can do it that way. But I think that that's a process that actually can never be successful, because like I said, diversity is natural and it will keep coming up. Or you can think in a different way. And this is why I like the work of Edouard Glissant, because he allows us to think in a different way, to accept that there is difference and to be able to withstand those tensions, because that is natural. And it does require work, like Tanya was saying. I'm not saying it's an easy process, but I feel like that's the only option we have if we want to live in a more equitable and peaceful world.
And one more point on that before we get Tom and Brighton on the phone. I really appreciate Mara's point about withstanding some tensions, because inevitably there will be some tensions. It doesn't mean we need to shut down the entire human civilization project, because at times people who come from different backgrounds have tensions. That's a natural byproduct of interaction. It doesn't have to be the only byproduct. So I appreciate that point. And then my mind goes straight back to Mary's point on starting with children, that children are curious. If you are living mostly homogeneously as your entire life into adulthood, it becomes a lot harder to think of diversity as something not to be feared. Tom in Brighton on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, most people, at least in my experience, don't reject diversity. It's just the problem is what happens when one of the participants was mentioning the situation in Venice, for instance, where, you know, the question is how do you correct when diversity becomes lessened? As, for instance, in Venice, when a plumber cannot afford to live there because it's become so expensive. Well, take the next step. What's going to happen? There's going to be a shortage of plumbers. The very wealthy people who live in Venice still need plumbers. What's going to happen? Either the pipes are going to continue to leak, and in Venice, that's a bad place for that to happen, as you know, or the value and the salary wages that have paid to plumbers will rise to the point where they will be able to afford to move back to Venice, and the situation will reach another point of equilibrium. So don't exclude the possibility that the free market can help solve that kind of a problem.
Okay. Tom, thank you. Yeah. Is there some logic there, Mary?
Well, you know, when you talk about real estate and housing, which, you know, is another kind of habitat, I think that it's a very, very delicate issue for many people, because obviously if you compartmentalize people in a city, you know, the wealthier members of society get to pick where they live, and people who are less fortunate get the less desirable places, and it goes on from there. Then this is exacerbated by the fact that in the United States, most people's net worth is tied into their home. So anything that happens next door to them that might affect the value of their home becomes very critical for them. So I think that someone in Venice would not necessarily want a plumber to live next door to them, because it might affect the perception of the value of their own home. I think it's more likely that they would have the plumber come and stay at their house for a week. And that's what I would see happening in Venice. So you get these like micro incursions into a more diverse environment. But anyway, I think we're oversimplifying that with that point a little bit, because diversity is one of the characteristics of resiliency, but it's not the only one. It works in tandem with other characteristics.
Yeah, and to Tom's point, I mean, there are aspects certainly to the free market theory that he is bringing up in the call that are hard to ignore. At the same time, money and elite and power protects power, mm-hmm. and having power, having money is a good way to get power in most parts of our world. And so if you don't want the plumbers living next door to you, you can decide ways to try to do that. And we do have societies where, yes, even though plumbers are needed, they still can't afford to live where they're needed most. So I think it's push-pull. So it's complicated.
I think it's very complicated, and I think to see that the free market will regulate and assure diversity at the end, because it will be to the benefits of the free market to bring diversity. I think it's an oversimplification. We've seen it again multiple times where, I teach history of feminism, and one of the schools of feminism as Marxist feminists who thought that if socialist revolution takes place, then all issues of gender inequality will be resolved. Well, socialist revolution takes place in Soviet Russia, and gender inequality remains as strong as ever. Socialist feminists suggested that, well, we actually have to address the issues of patriarchy, and patriarchy as a structure actually remains stable, whether it's socialist system or capitalist system. So it's not always economics. There are cultural conversations, there are issues of racism and patriarchy that are not going to go away with free market supposedly regulatory forces. So,
okay, Mara?
I just wanted to add, you know, also, I think it kind of reminds us that diversity is not just about interpersonal relationships. It's not about having, you know, a friend who's a person of color or who has a different religion or a different background. We're also talking about systems. So, for example, in terms of real estate, you know, I'm thinking of the segregation in the city of Rochester. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about redlining, mm-hmm. You know, how people are concentrated in certain parts of the city and how where they're concentrated also affects, you know, their poverty level or their wealth level or the kind of education that their children can get and stuff like that. So we're definitely talking about systems as well, not just interpersonal, you know, compatibility.
Let me get the second point that Dan wants to raise for our panel. He writes the following. The term diversity has come to refer largely to diversity of race or of gender. And while these may be important traits, the cost of this pigeonholing is that all other forms of diversity are relegated to secondary consideration if they are considered at all. We are led to believe that a group of, say, 65-year-old all-white men or 40-year-old black women is not a diverse group on their own, simply because they are the same age, race, and gender. We might contend that there is a problematic lack of diversity among the group. This is conjecture and extremely reductionist at that. Is there anything contributing to who you are as a person beyond your age, race, and gender? Of course there is, so let's not ignore that.
Mary, you talked a little bit before the show about other diversity issues, and I think you wanted to mention a few. Do you want to go back to your... I don't want to steal that point from you.
Well, no, there's really nothing to steal. It's yes, we do talk about diversity in terms of people a lot because that's part of what the prevailing conversation is right now. But I think you can probably address the rest of that a little bit better than I can.
Right. Well, Mary and I were having a conversation that there are, first of all, other issues... disability, ageism, so, and when we talk about diversity, we usually include those as well. Issues of
sexual orientation.
Yes. And I think here, once again, we are dealing with this kind of substitute of a concept for what we're trying to do. So we talk about diversity, and if we're looking at a group of black women who are sitting in the same room and perhaps making important decisions, they're not diverse. This is not about creating, just like intersectionality is not just a combination of different identities. It's intersectionality is about overlapping structures of power or structures of oppression. So same things, diversity is not about making sure that there's a person represents each and every aspect of diversity in every room. It's allowing people who don't have access to systems and structures of power to participate in decision-making process and lifting them to this. So if there is a group of black women sitting in a room and making decisions, I think it's diversity because they members of African American community in the States often excluded from this process of decision making. So diversity, again, is not just going around making sure that we have one of every kind. It is about lifting people and making sure that they participate in power decisions.
Okay. Mary?
Yeah, and I'd like to know also when we can start to focus on all the things we have in common instead of all the things that make us different from one another.
Okay. Mara, you want to add to any of what you heard there?
No, I think that, you know, what Tanya was saying makes a lot of sense. And again, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that we want to have this conversation. We kind of want to reboot the language that we use when we think of diversity, you know, and that's why I'm bringing in these philosophical concepts that are quite opposed to what to the way that we think.
Yeah, and I think inferring from Dan's email, and I don't want to speak for him, but he seems to be saying, you know, diversity of thought should be considered important, but it seems that we are ascribing characteristics to entire groups. If we see, okay, that's 65-year-old white men, here's 40-year-old black women, here so-and-so, that we assume that we know how they think, how they view the world, and we don't allow for diversity of thought within sort of, I guess you would call, subgroups. Is that fair or unfair? Is that a valid concern, Professor?
Okay, let's see if I understand it. So we think that a group of 65-year-old white men would not be able to think on behalf of other groups. Is that what you're saying?
Perhaps, that they will not be... that if you meet someone who is 28 years old, and a white gay person, we think that we can understand a lot about them before we even have a conversation. Is that a problem, or is right. that just a natural consequence of understanding how identity works?
That's perhaps how identity works, and that's why we need diversity. Because if a 65-year-old white man spends some time in a group where opinions are diverse, experiences are diverse, and where people share their stories, they share their backgrounds, that perhaps even that 65-year-old white man, by the way, I have nothing against 65-year-old
no,
white
no, men. We're using Dan's
married
email.
To one, so, if a white man of that age spends time with a group of diverse people and hears their opinions, I think that essentially might change the way he thinks and mm-hmm. might lead to a productive conversation and to him being able to speak on behalf of this group of people. So, but diversity is crucial for this process of learning, all of us. What do I know about 20-year-old gay male experience? But I'd like to learn.
Okay. Mark.
Exactly. I think that's the negotiations that Edouard Glissant is talking about, the constant negotiations that are happening. And that's why he says, if you really want to map diversity, you have to look in the in-between sites, in the borderlands, in the liminal passages and thresholds. That's where the energy is coming from, because that's where the negotiations are happening. And that's where we're constantly learning and evolving and changing, hopefully.
Well, Curtis writes to the program and says, please give the name of that French philosopher again.
Edouard Glissant, Glissant.
Okay. Thank you, Curtis. You always get a lesson when Mara and her associates are with us here. In our last few minutes, let me grab Will, who says, I agree that Will emails the program to say, I agree that diversity could be looked at as neither good nor bad, but simply as a component inherent in the nature of our collective being. I do find an alternate perspective in thinking of a world without it, though, compared with the wonderfully nuanced global society that exists, however plagued by inequality. A society without all of this cultural spice would be categorically bland.
Yeah.
That is from Will.
Thank you, Will.
Unbearable. Yes. Bland and unbearable, really. And static, because we wouldn't change, right? We wouldn't learn anything.
Right. And I think we have to move from a place of fear to a place of anticipation. So rather than saying, who knows what might happen if I were in proximity to mm-hmm. so-and-so, to who knows what might happen.
Yeah.
And that could be an exciting, good thing.
And embracing that fear. I mean, yes, we are afraid. We are afraid to be more diverse because we're afraid that someone else will be making decisions for us. And I don't know what this person knows about me. So why would this person be making decisions on my behalf? So we are afraid. We're resistant. We're uncertain. And I think, yes, just embracing all of this and seeing it as an important learning process and as actually exciting learning process. I think it's a good thing.
All right, in our last 90 seconds or so, I just want to mention again, part of what's going on here in Rochester is that the city of Rochester today rolled out their participation in a multi-year project called Let's Get Real, REAL, standing for Race, Equity, and leadership. And part of the goals there represent some significant change. They want to affect policy regarding the effects of redlining, school segregation, et cetera. I mean, these are all separate and lengthy conversations. Strong civic engagement. They want accurate and complete portrayals of people in color in our community. That means in the media, that means in various settings, et cetera. And Mara, as someone who is obviously very experienced in media presentation, in our last minute or so, just give me a sense for how do you think, is our society getting any better at sort of how the media portrays people of color, people from diverse backgrounds? Do we still caricature? Are we lacking in this? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, we do caricature. Remember, I had this discussion here on the show about Serena Williams and how she was being caricatured. So yeah, we still do that. And the sad thing is that we have such a beautiful country, which is so diverse and so exciting and so dynamic, but somehow our culture does not reflect that. And that to me is so sad because the potential is definitely there. It's just a matter of empowering all these wonderful storytellers and then just enjoying and learning from all these stories.
All right, 30 seconds. The event is on Saturday, 2:00 at the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. From Inclusion to Equity, the Diversity Advantage. It's at 2:00, free and open to the public. What are people going to gain from this experience, Mara?
Hopefully, it's going to change the way that we think about diversity. And I also want to mention that people have to register. They can go on the Gandhi Institute website and register for this event.
Okay. So please, if you're so inclined, you can check that out at the Gandhi Institute's website. And I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time to be here and embrace complexity. Professor, we're going to embrace complexity. We're not going to be fearful of complexity. Professor Tanya Bakhmetyeva, who's an associate professor of gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Rochester, thank you for your expertise and time
today.
Thank you. Mara Ahmed, always nice to talk to you. A political activist, an artist and writer, an independent filmmaker at Neelam Films, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Mary Scipione, a landscape architect, writer and critic, owner of Pebble Stream, and apparently a Connections show caller who's... Her phone call helped lead to this program. Thank you for doing that and for stepping up, and thanks for being here. I appreciate your wisdom today.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.